Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a rousing welcome to our warm-up speaker, Ron.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name's Ron. I'm an alcoholic. I'm the big warm-up speaker. I'm already pretty hot, so it should be pretty easy. Any other alcoholics out there tonight? Oh, thank God. I don't have to do this alone. This is a great program. You know, it's a wee program for me. You know, I like to talk a little bit about my experience. And, you know, we already read it. Maddie read it tonight, chapter 3. That was my experience. For years, I tried to drink like a normal drinker, you know. I was chasing a hole in my soul and I could never fill it. I always tried to fill it with booze. You know, with booze came all my character defects, you know. Acting out, not being responsible, not being a good husband and father, you know, chasing women, all that stuff, you know. I wasn't very happy with myself, you know, when I'd sober up. You know, I was a binge drinker. I could go for months without drinking. So I could fool myself that I wasn't a real alcoholic. You know, I didn't drink every day. I didn't lose a job. But that changed, you know, that changed as with time went on, you know. It's a deadly disease and it's progressive. So, you know, I grew up in the Midwest where you could drink at 18 at beer parties. You know, so I really didn't drink in high school because I was, you know, played a lot of sports. I came from a little small whole bunch of town, you know. There was we played 8-man football and 3 of them were my brothers. That's how small the town was, you know. You had to be careful you were dating your cousins, you know. That's how small my town was. So, and I did date one of my cousins, okay. She was the best looking one. But, you know, that small town stuff, you know, you always hear it, you know. I hear it as I grew up and I, you know, my kids grew up, oh, there's nothing to do in this small town but drink, you know. Wow, what a great excuse for an alcoholic, you know. So I started drinking about 18. I drank alcohol free from the get-go, you know. I was a blackout drinker, you know. I drank and I remember 2-3 hours of what the hell I did that night, you know. But it never stopped me, you know. It never stopped me from drinking. I always tried to find a way around controlling that drinking. I always wanted to be a big shot. You know, booze made me equal, made me 6'1", 180 pounds, good looking, you know. But that wasn't true either, but I kept that denial, you know, that denial we talk about. So my life, I was always running from things. So, you know, the minute I graduated from high school, I went to work in Detroit in 1968. That was really a smart move. If you remember, that was when the civil rights was really hopping in here. A little white boy from Wisconsin goes to Detroit. That was probably not a smart move. You know, I ended up working at a little factory where everybody was either black or from Tennessee, and they all drank, you know, moonshine at their breaks at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. So I got my ass pretty screwed up there, and I decided to drag my butt back to my little hometown and go to college. I was going to go to college. Well, if I did that, I went back to college, and I think I, for those of you who watched National Lampoon, you know, here I was going to college, and I was lovesick about my high school sweetheart, who really didn't give a shit about me, but I was in love with her, and, you know, it was only 50 miles away, but for me, it was like, you know, a million miles, and not doing well in school, so instead of buckling down, I drank more, you know, and I think I, at the end of the first semester, I had a 0.01 grade point average. You know, that's not going to go well, you know. So I did the only thing I could do, you know. I volunteered for the draft because I knew that not only would I get my tuition money back, which was $90 back then, but I'd get all my grades. My grades would be expunged. So I could start over someday, maybe. So that's what I did. I volunteered for the draft in 1968. Drunker than hell. And you had to go to your, at that time you had to go down where you were registered in the county where you live, and it was a little town, another little town. And it's the nearest town that had a hospital. My mother happened to be in the hospital for some surgery or something when I, you know, came to the next morning on a park bench outside the bus depot, and so I decided to walk over and show her that, you know, I Mom, I volunteered for the Army. And she looked at me, and you know, I expected all this, oh my God, come here, son. You know, and she goes, well, it looks like you made your bed, now you can sleep, you know. Well, you have to understand, my mother had 10 other kids to worry about, so she really, you know, she's pretty busy. But that's the kind of life I had. You know, I grew up with a lot of resentments. I grew up with resentments about I was either less than or I thought I was better than, but mostly it was less than. I didn't like being poor, and I didn't like, I was embarrassed that our family was on welfare. So I was going to go out and talk to the world and just shove it up those people back there's asses that I was, you know, I was better than them, you know. And so I went into the Army and I survived that, and I went to Vietnam and I survived that, luckily, you know. And I came back and I, well, you know, the service is great for drinking because you work hard all week and then you get Liberty Call or you go down to the post and drink and raise hell, and everybody thought that was what sailor soldiers do, you know, that's what we do, you know, no harm, no foul, and make sure you show up for the 5:30, you know, roll call, and hopefully have your boots laced and you're standing up straight, so. Anyway, so that's what my life was like. You know, my life was about trying to find a hole to fill put something in that hole that I couldn't find, you know. So I was always running to something, but I always forgot that I took the problem with me. And it was me. You know, my gift of desperation came to me on the weekend of Father's Day, June 17, 1999. Now, the reason I tell you that date is, there's two reasons. One is, it's good for me to remember that I received the gift of desperation the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was lost, I was desperate, I had no hope. You know, I was afraid of a God I knew growing up, and I had no hope. How can I? And I never really wanted to stop. Let's not kid each other. I just wanted to control it. You know? So I'd make lies to my wife. I'd say, okay, I'll have two. So I'd have two beers, and she'd go to the bathroom. I'd have two tequilas, and she'd go to the bathroom later on. And I'd have two sambucas. You know, I wasn't really lying. Of course I was lying, you know, I couldn't control it. Or I could go 3 or 4 weeks with only having two, and I just hated that feeling. You know, I just hated that feeling that I could only have two. So anyway, that's my experience. You know, there's a lot of stories I could tell, but we all know what it's about. It's just not being a good guy, you know, not being a good guy. So I was desperate. I went to my employer and said, you know, I'm really stressed out. I'm a nurse, and I was working for God's years, and I managed 81 women and 7 guys. Now, I love women. My mother was a woman. My sisters are women. My wife's a woman. My daughter's a woman. So managing 81 women, I had a real reason to drink, you know. So I thought they'd say, you poor bastard, you're just stressed. Why don't you take some time off? And so we did the inventory, and she goes, you have a real problem with alcohol, don't you? And that's the first time we ever admitted it. It really meant it. I do. I need help. And they helped me. Yeah, I went to intensive outpatient program. That doesn't mean I got bonked on the head, because I didn't get that gift of desperation until after, a year later, until after I went and started going to AA meetings. When I walked into my AA meeting in my local town of Sonoma. You know, I saw something that you guys had. You had, even though you went through all this crap, and you know, and we can compare who has the worst story, and there are some people that are like, holy shit, you know, that's a, I'm not that bad. Maybe I came in too early, you know. But you know, the truth of the matter is, I was not happy with who I was. I ran for years from myself. You know, I always blame, I'm the middle child, so am I screwed up? I need attention, you know, all that bullshit. You know, you have 5 brothers this side and 5 sisters this side. I should have been crazy. But anyway, but I never got that gift of desperation until I could surrender completely to step one. I always joke around with my buddies in AA that have some sobriety, and I say, you know, I'm an alcoholic and my wife is unmanageable. You know, I joke, and but the truth of the matter is, it was my life that was unmanageable. You know, it's not my wife. It wasn't my, I couldn't get sober for my wife or my kids. You know, my employer. I had to get sober for me. And if I can give any message tonight, for me, it worked. But my experiences, until I wanted it, it wasn't going to work. And once I wanted it, slowly but surely, when I came to surrender completely to step one, that I am an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable. And it doesn't matter if I drink or not, my life is still unmanageable if I don't work the other 11 steps. It's pretty simple. But my mind is so screwed up, I make it complicated. You know, once I was able to completely surrender to step one, then I could come to believe there's a power greater than myself. And I got to tell you, people, I was so afraid of the Catholic God I grew up with, I was sure I was going to hell forever. I was going to burn for all those things I did, you know. But that's not what I found here. I found a higher power that's a loving higher power. higher power that forgave me so I could forgive myself, so I could begin to build my life again, you know. AA has not given me my old life back, thank God. Just given me a whole new life, you know. I work the first 4 steps every morning before I roll out of the rack, you know. I'm grateful today for the things I have, not for what I don't have or what I've lost, you know. Do I have regrets? Sure, I have regrets. You know, I didn't marry my first wife and have children with her and plan on divorcing her, you know. That's a regret that I have to live with. I have to accept the responsibility. My behavior ruined that marriage. You know, it ruined that marriage. There's always take two to tango, but I had a huge part of that. And I never faced it and accepted that every time I got in trouble, it involved alcohol. And I never could really accept that until I came into the doors of AA in June of 1999 and started working the program to the best of my ability. And the only thing I have to do perfect is step one. So 1 out of 12, that's about what, 83% of the shit I can do wrong. That's pretty cool. That sounds like a civil service job. Yes. Hey, I'm retired Navy, so I can take over from Joe for him. But, you know, the message I have is, you know, I was talking to Otter on the way down, you know, it's, once I lose step one, everything goes down the toilet, you know. And step two, there is a power greater than myself, you know. I don't know how much time I have left, but my mother was obviously Catholic, having 11 kids. Hello, Mom. Anyway, but she always had a faith, you know. She lived in some real crappy places. I remember when we didn't get electricity until I was 13 years old. And that may not sound too bad, except that some of the places we lived in, holy shit. And she had all these kids to clean and cook for, and her life was just, oh, she was always depressed. And I was like, Mom's so depressed, what the hell's wrong with her? And then, of course, I got to be 25 and have 2 kids. I said, I know what's wrong with Mom now. She had 11 kids. So she'd always say, you got to have faith, Mom. Faith, you know, I couldn't get it. You know, Mom, I'm smarter than you. I'm a college graduate. You know, the cosmos, the universe, evolution, I'm all screwed up. But, you know, that's what it boils down to. You got to have faith. You know, faith will push fear out. My two biggest emotions are fear and faith. As long as I keep track of and a hold on faith, that I have faith that my higher power today, no matter what comes down the road that I must face, he will show me the way to get through that without drinking. You know, without drinking. I was able to bury my dad sober, and I was able to bury my mom sober. And those, for me, those are big things. Those are big things. You know, my life has gotten so, you know, just, I can't begin to share how great it is. I would talk about the journey, and Freeman always gives me crap about it. It's my journey, and damn it, I'm sticking to it. It's a great journey as long as I get up in the morning, I'm grateful for what I had yesterday, and I'm looking forward to what I have today, and I can be a better person than I was yesterday. And it doesn't work every day, no. But the trend line is always up. My trend line is always up, you know. It's, you know, amazingly, I retired last year and I ended up moving to Visalia. That should be punishment enough. No, I'm kidding. I'm getting used to the heat now. But, because my son married a girl from Visalia, and so I spent a lot of time now with my wife, who, she didn't retire, she just never went back to work, if you know what I mean. So, it's like, wow, I thought when I retired I'm not going to be one of those AA Nazis and go to meetings all the time. You know? That's bullshit. I'm not going to trade that addiction for this addiction. You know, I'm going to enjoy life. I'm going to golf. I'm going to travel and do all this stuff. I go to at least 6 things a week. And the biggest reason is because I remind you to keep my mouth shut most of the time when I'm talking to my wife. I don't control the world anymore, you know. I don't have to control the world. I don't have to control my kids and my adult children. It's their journey. You know, I can be there for them now. I don't have to rule the world, you know. What a relief that is, you know. You know, the dog still crashed in the yard. I just had to put a new bearing in my truck. I would be drunk over that before. Like, holy shit, the world's picking on me. Everybody hates my guts. But you know what? My gratitude sets my attitude. And if you're new, and welcome to the newcomer, Paul. It's great that you're here, you know. You know, if you're new or if you're struggling, you know, as we all do at certain periods in our recovery, you know, I just hope that you can find what I found here, and that is a higher power that's loving, that I'm powerless over my life without that higher power in my life. and then I can follow the other steps, and it really is quite easy to do. And once, you know, now that I have a few years under my belt, even though I only have 24 hours at a time, that's important for me. Remember that? I have several chips, but I only keep the 24-hour chip in my pocket, because that's all I have. You know, I'm only arm length away from that first drink. You know, and then it's all gone again. You know, and we know it, we hear it, we lose people, because this disease is progressive. I may not have touched alcohol for 15 years, but my disease has gone on. You know, and I'm sure that if I would just put alcohol in my body, it would probably just take a couple of days and I'd be to where I worse than I ever was. So I choose every morning, I love to share it with Andre. You know, I do the turning point thing every morning. I stand at the turning point every morning. I choose to go back to that old life. All I gotta do is walk down the liquor store and buy a bottle. They're not gonna say, Ronnie, it's not like being back in my hometown, like, your mother said I couldn't sell you this. You know? They're not gonna say it. They go, shit, yeah, it's $9 or whatever it is. They don't care. But I care. I care about my life today. And my life has been enriched in so many ways. My adult children and I are really close. I have six wonderful grandkids. You know, and I actually speak to my 10 brothers and sisters. That's amazing, because I was always the black sheep that took off. They said, you guys, I'm never coming back here. You guys are a bunch of scum buckets, you know? I was the scum bucket. You know, my daddy always used to say, if you meet more than one asshole in the day, you're probably the asshole. With that, I hope everybody has a great night, and thanks for letting me share.
Okay, let's give a warm round of applause for our featured speaker, Audra.
Thank you. I'm Audra and I'm an alcoholic. A real alcoholic. And Ron set the bar fairly high for me there. So I don't know whether I'd make it or not, but I'm going to give it a run anyway. And there's one thing I've got to get straight here first. I'm trying hard to develop the Tulare brogue. Some people think I'm from Tulare, but you know, maybe by my story you'll figure out I'm thinking wrong. I was born in Ireland quite a few years ago. And I don't know if any of you ever heard this when you were growing up. Your mother, if you're going out at night, and your mother would always say, now be careful. Be careful of the crowd you run around with. Don't run around with the wrong crowd. I never could figure out who that crowd were. Who was the wrong crowd? Until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So this must be the crowd she was talking about. And I'm grateful I found the wrong crowd, if we want to look at it that way. I did go back to Ireland to do a nice step one time, and my sister happened to ask me, a sister that still doesn't believe why I'm staying sober, how I'm staying sober, and how this program works. She figures I still don't. I'd never developed any willpower. But she said to me, how did you get sober? And I didn't know what to say at the time. I was only about 18 months sober. And I said, I hang out with the wrong crowd. And you should have seen the confusion between three of us in that room for about 10 minutes, and I had to get up and leave. And so they never asked me to explain who the wrong crowd was, like, you know, but I know today it's the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how I got sober. But I was born in Ireland, and I'm seventh of eight kids, second from the bottom. And I remember them asking me at the dinner table, how come you look as if you can't fit in? You can't just fit in. You're not part of the family. And I don't know. That's just the way I am. And I never understood why I could, and I never felt part of the family. And I didn't stay in Ireland. I stayed in Ireland until I was 20, but I played football a lot. The game where everybody kicks the ball, you know what I mean? One of those games. It's an Irish game. It's not like your soccer, so don't come down on me about the World Cup. No, it's a Gaelic game. It's a Gaelic football. It's only played in Ireland and every city in America where you have more than 15 Irish guys. Emigrants. Now, I won't tell you their status in the country, so we leave it at that. That's for another program. But anyway, I could never feel part of the team even when I was on a team, and we might be winning, and I never felt part of it, and I never understood why, until I found, you call it John Barleycorn, until I found Arthur Guinness, you know, at a very young age, found Guinness anyway, sipping the bottles around the fire at home. My father drank hard, my mother never drank much at all, and eight of us in the family, and there's two drunks. My father was a hard drinker, and I don't know whether he was a drunk or not, or whether he was an alcoholic. But I do know one thing, is that I'm an alcoholic. And that's all that's important to me today. And I talked to my brother a lot. He's in the program too. He got sober on the first Sunday in 1972 in September. He doesn't know what date it was, but he knows it was the first Sunday in 1972, and he hasn't had a drink since. I never knew this, because he was in England, and I worked, when I left school, I became part of the Agricultural Free Labour Association. I went to work for my old fella. So the work was hard, money was scarce, hours were long, and I think we had five girls, he had five daughters and two and three sons, and I think he was pissed off he didn't have eight sons. So he'd have a whole free labour pool. The cheap labour pool of Ireland. But, you know, I was raised with five sisters and a mother, and you know what, when you come to our house today, the toilet seat, I guarantee you, is always down. That's the thing I learned at a very young age. Never leave the toilet seat up. Especially when you don't have electricity into the house. But, I worked at home with the old man for 4 years, and I used to always see these big jet planes passing over, and I'd see the contrails from them, and I always wondered where the hell they were going. They'd be heading west, so they must have been heading for America. And I'd always say to myself, you won't always be leaving without me. I'll get on you one of these days, and I'm leaving. Had no money to leave because the wages were low, work was long and hard, but we had a lot of sheep on the farm. And we're dairy farmers, like around here, but not near as big as you guys. But I have some sheep stories, but that's for another program. But anyway, we leave the sheep out of it for tonight. And I was put in charge of the sheep anyway. So the old fella got wind that I was talking about leaving anyway, so he gave me four sheep for myself. Four ewes. The first year, every one of them had three lambs. I was in charge of the count and the branding, and I had my own brand. And he says to me about two years, he says, I gave you four sheep and now you have 24. And 2 years, yeah, I says, yeah, they're all very fruitful sheep. And of course I was branding his with my brand. And otherwise I would never have seen the fair shores of America. I wouldn't have a first time. So anyway, I sold my little flock anyway, and I bought a ticket on one of those big jets that was going somewhere. And I went to the embassy in Dublin anyway, the American embassy, and tried to get into the state. And they said, no, you don't have any relations out here, nobody to claim you. And I said, no. Well, they said, we can't do anything for you. So the next bet was I went to Canada. So I got a flight to Canada. I got into Canada in 3 weeks, man. I had on my resume, farmer's son, 4 years experience, and boy, they took me in a heartbeat. And I was here milking at home in Ireland, milking cows twice a day, 7 days a week, and trying to play football and drink and have a social life, which wasn't possible. And I arrived in Canada anyway, and was coming into the emigration place, this big room, and I saw this big green sign up there, and you know what, I was sure I'd arrived in heaven. It said, drink Canada dry. I said, met a few guys in their 20s like myself on the plane coming over, and they said, what a country. We go to work straight away. We weren't really worried about what it paid for, but we tried our best anyway. But when I was leaving, there was still alcohol left. And I went to the manpower the next morning, and he said, I got a job for you. He says, it's $120 a month, hard cash. I says, that's the job for me. And I says, what's it doing? He says, working on a farm. I says, on a farm? What type of a farm? He says, a dairy farm. I says, jeez, I should turn around and go home. I could have done this in Ireland. But I took the job anyway for 1 month. I told myself that I got a few dollars. I only had about 25 bucks in my pocket at the time. So I went out on this farm out in the middle of Ontario. And would you believe, when I got there, the first instructions I got, that there was no alcohol allowed in the house. And I says, my God, what a place to land. So he had about 150 cows or something, and I tell you one thing for sure, I never saw as many horse things in all my life. And I was praying for sheep. It didn't work, but anyway, they left me in charge of the house this weekend, and they all took off. Somehow I was able to con one of the other guys who was working there, brought me out a case of Molson X and a bottle of Black Velvet. Never heard of Black Velvet. I heard of the song, the Black Velvet Band. But they came home at 2 o'clock in the morning from some big function they were at anyway, and I was stretched out on the floor and bottles everywhere. And man, I was nearly going. There was nearly that whole Inquisition all over again. They were wonderful people, don't get me wrong, but they had their rules and regulations that they didn't touch alcohol, which was all right. But it wasn't all right for me. But I left there anyway, and I went to Toronto, the big city, and got introduced to the bright city lights. And first thing I saw in the morning when I woke up, I saw Lake Ontario, and I thought I was on the coast. I never saw a lake so big. I couldn't see the far side of it. Couldn't see what the neighbors were doing in the next county. But I got introduced. I was walking down the street one time, and I saw this bar with a shamrock in the window, and I says, I'm going in here, there's something, some bit of a connection. So I went in anyway, and there was this guy playing the accordion, playing Irish music, and in the middle of an Italian neighborhood. And we struck up a conversation, and he gave me some phone numbers, and that's how I got introduced to Irish guys. I didn't know anybody in Canada, but that's when I got started working in the business that I got into, was tunnel business, digging tunnels and subways and water tunnels and underground. And the condition of being hired there was, superintendent wouldn't hire you unless you drank. This is back in the 60s. And didn't trust you if you didn't drink. Remember when you were out there and you didn't like being around the guy that only sipped on his drink? Didn't trust him and didn't want a man to do it. And it was the same business that was. You had to be a drinker, falling down drunk, so people could trust you. We drank on the job, and we made good money, and we drank hard. But we never saved anything. At that time we were taking home, clearing about $220 a week. And I knew people that were taking home $86 a week working in offices, and they were paying a mortgage on the house. And I was broke 3 days after payday. Between going to the racetrack and missing the days at work and doing the thing what a good alcoholic practicing does. And you know what? Back in Ireland when I really started drinking when I was 16. Before that I was sipping it. And I remember I was down by the... My story is connected to two lakes. One where I was on my knees in Ireland throwing up one night, and tears coming out of my eyes, and swearing that I would do this again. We had a wonderful night, and I couldn't wait to do it all over again. I was only 16. And then when I came to the end of my rope up in Lake, Shaver Lake, and Lake with Sean was on Shaver Lake actually, on the bank of it, about 30 years ago, 33 years ago, I was on my knees crying, throwing up, and I said, I can't do this anymore. That's what alcohol had done to me. And that's how I'm connected to two lakes, one in California and one in County Wicklow, Ireland. But I had read about the Yukon. I'd read a lot about the Yukon in geography lessons and everything back in school, and I really loved the stories and the wild, free, fearless life, you know, that they had up there during the gold rush. And I quit my job. I got talking to a guy in a pub in Toronto, and he was telling me about all this money they were making in the Yukon. And I said, that's where I'm going. Quit my job. Of course, he got my job. He told me all about his money. He got my job the day I left. And I took a ferocious cut in pay when I did get a job in the Yukon, and I had to pay my own room and board, and worked in the wilderness up in the Arctic and the mines, and drank. And I drank myself out of... I remember I went to the bank manager up there in the Yukon in Dawson, just outside Dawson City in a town called Elsa. It was a gold mine. And I went into the bank manager and I said, I'm looking for a loan. And he says, you are you? I says, yeah. But he says, I'm going to tell you something before we waste this paperwork. He said, you drank all your own money, he says, and now you want to drink mine. So I didn't get a loan from him, I can tell you that. But they're the sort of things I used to do. I had no value on money unless it was being invested in alcohol. I went home to Ireland one time and my mother asked me, how was I investing my money? And I says, yeah, I'm investing it all the time. Every week I invest the majority of my money in Milwaukee. She had no idea where Milwaukee was. She thought it was a big business area, which I suppose it is, but mine was going to Milwaukee for brewers. But my brother popped on to what I was saying. He says, come on, you go to hell for that. But, I never knew what it was like to fit in anywhere without alcohol. I could not, no matter what I did. I went out so many nights, and I didn't get into trouble every night I went out drinking. But any time I was in trouble, I was drunk. It was associated with alcohol. And, you know, my old man passed away in 69, and I went back home for that. My mother asked me to stay at home in Ireland or work on the farm. I said, no, can't be done. It'll probably float off down the river. I'd probably drink it out, which I probably would. And even guys that I was drinking with advised me not to have anything to do with the farm. The farm is still in the family name today. But it wouldn't have been if I'd have been there in charge. I know that for a fact. And I even knew it back then. And it wasn't the fact that when I was flying out of Ireland in 1966, I looked down and we're coming up out of Dublin, and I said I'd never live there, but I'd come back on vacation. I even knew that at the time. I didn't want to live there because I wanted what was over there. Over there. Over the hill and far away from what? I don't know. Me, I guess, but I got on the plane every time with me. And, you know, I could not figure that out. I could not figure it out why I was quitting jobs, getting fired. I didn't have to quit too many jobs, to tell you the truth. I only quit one or two jobs. I got fired for every one of them, the majority of them. But you know, I got fed up in Toronto and was on a good job in Toronto, the one of the best paying jobs for a working man like myself. And I always wanted to go to New York City. So I got a ticket to New York anyway, and somehow or other I got into the immigration with a good line of Blarney. I don't know what it was, or the immigration officer was drunk or something, but he let me in anyway. And so I told him I was going to the County Tipperary. So that was near enough. He says, go ahead. He thought it was back in Ireland. But I went to work at the same business in New York, sandhogging in the tunnels. And you know, New York City in the Bronx, it's an alcoholic's paradise. The bars never close. You know, they close down for... They close the door for a few hours to swamp up, but you never have to leave. Especially, the majority of them are run by the Irish guys anyway. And so you always have somewhere to go. And there's always a back room. It's amazing. None of them was ever built with just one big room. They have a back room where you can lay down, sleep it off, and continue. And you don't really need an apartment. If that's the life you want to live. But, you know, I still wasn't happy there. And then we got word of You know, New York went bankrupt in the early 70s and mid 70s, so they started building the pipeline in Alaska, and most of us that were working in the tunnels, we headed for the pipeline in Alaska, and I went to Fairbanks. Some guys went to Anchorage, more than Valdez, and got a job there. I wasn't there too long, got a job, but of course I wasn't fired off the first job. I quit that job, but then I got fired off the next one. But then the third job I was going out on, I happened to get very drunk celebrating that I got this great job that everyone was looking for. It was a blaster's job up on the North Slope, and I had explosive experience. That had nothing got to do with coming from Ireland, no. Don't get me wrong. It was working in the mines, and I had a blaster's permit and everything, and I got very drunk and I headed for the airport, which I shouldn't have done, and I am a lucky man to be here talking to you, but they wouldn't let me on the plane because I was too drunk. And of course, me and my wisdom and my control of my English language, I told them that if they didn't like it, I was going to take that plane, and this is 1975, and I was going to fly it myself, and if they weren't happy, I was going to blow it up. So bells went off and lights flashed. I was on the ground, I was in cuffs, and I had this big parka on me that I was, you know, it was about 50 below outside, and I was heading up into the Arctic, but they threw me in the big back room anyway with a big cage, and lo and behold, the airport police were involved, the city police, the county, the Mountie guys, the guys that never fail to get their van. And then who arrived in the door? Only the FBI. So they looked at my credentials and they saw this explosive certificate, and things were going wild back in Ireland at the time, and here I was. And lucky enough, they evaluated me, and they knew I was drunk. But they did check with Interpol and everything, because there was a lot of guys on the run from Ireland and all the troubles that were going on. But I was okay. I was gone so long that I wasn't involved in it. But they happened to let me go after about 24 hours in custody. And so I was lucky enough to get off that whole scene. And still, there were situations that you think that I would have learned something connected with alcohol. But no, I went back to town that evening, and I started drinking again. Got loaded again. But lucky enough, I went to work the next day, the next 2 days after that, and there was a guy with me, and he warned me to keep my mouth shut. And I got up to the North Slope anyway, and lasted about 8 weeks, and then it was time to go to town. But I worked 3 years in the pipeline, and when I was headed back to New York City, I had to borrow $100 to make up the price of my ticket. And there was people coming out of there with good stakes that set them up for the rest of their life. And after that, all that hardship connected with alcohol and the craziness and the insanity of my drinking, I was broke, leaving Alaska in the mid 77, 78. And but I headed back anyway. I ended up back in Ireland, and with the help of the immigration, they finally caught up with my dead ass, caught me drunk in bed one morning, and put the cuffs on me, and they said, "You're out of here, buddy. You don't have the right papers." I said, "Okay." So I borrowed the money and paid my own way home, and that's the reason I'm here today. Because if you don't pay your own way out of the country, you're done for life. You'll not get back in. So, and I knew that at the time, but I ended up then, I went to the Middle East out of, you know, of all the places. There was after being a bombing out there, I went out to Saudi Arabia, and we first worked for General Electric, putting in drilling holes for deep foundations and all that stuff, caissons. But made it back to London. I was 14 weeks in Saudi Arabia, and I never drank. And I was sure I had this drinking under control. I was in charge now. I remember getting off the plane in London. I had a pocket full of money, and I had a son in hand that had beat the band. Baby, I had arrived, man. I had the world by the collar. I knew what was needed. I went in and I ordered 1 pint of Carling Black Label. And I remember drinking that, and I don't remember anything for about 4 days after that. That's how so much in control I was of my alcoholism. Didn't know I was an alcoholic at the time. But definitely, the bartender had something against Irish guys. He spiked my drink. Son of a gun. Made it back to Ireland anyway, and my mother told me, she says, first thing you do, give me your passport. So I gave her my passport. So she always held the passport. She knew once she had the passport, I couldn't go anywhere. Once she had it, I wasn't gone, because I'd be gone for weeks when I'd be on vacation. She never knew where I was at. And I was only harming myself. Why did they not understand that I was the one that was sick in the morning, not them? And I couldn't understand why she kept harping on me. You need to do something about your drinking. You need to do something about your drinking. And I, you know, I did try. I did try. There were days I didn't drink. There were days I was too sick to drink. But there were days I honestly tried not to drink and not to pick up that first drink. Didn't know that that was the one that got me. But I failed. And then I might drink for 2 or 3 days, 4 or 5 drinks. And I would be so proud of myself. And I said, man, you deserve a party, man. You're after 4 days. 4 days without a drink. And then I'd go on a runner, could be for 4 weeks. And then it'd be the same old rigmarole again. Cops, you know, beatings, fights, and broken noses, and all that stuff that goes along with being a practicing alcoholic. That doesn't happen. It hasn't happened to me since I put down, threw up my last drink. And I still did not associate. But I made my way back to New York. Went back into the same business, into the tunnels. Once you get established in that type of business, you can always come back to it. And I could not understand how there were so many guys working on that job that never missed a day's work. Never. Never missed a day's work. And my week started mostly on a Wednesday. So I needed Wednesday, Thursday and Friday for beer and drinking money. And I was always crashing somewhere. I really didn't have an apartment or anywhere to live. And I definitely didn't have a girlfriend, I can tell you that for a fact, because I'd meet a girlfriend every now and again, like myself, you know, an old falling down drunk, and we'd drunk and we'd drink and tell each other our sad tales and pass out at the counter. We'd be there in the morning when we'd wake up. Would start drinking again. That's as far as it ever went. And that was the story of the last few years of my drinking. But I don't know what really possessed me. I had made so many trips across the States. I'd get on the plane in LaGuardia, I'd leave the Bunratty Bar in the Bronx, go out to LaGuardia, get on a plane, land in San Francisco, go to the Blarney Stone pub on Geary or the Abbey Tavern. From one bar, from one coast to the other, from bar to bar. And could not understand why my life wasn't changing. Because I was always going over that horizon for a whole new beginning. A whole new beginning. It never worked. Could not figure it out. And I thought myself a smart individual. You know, if you didn't understand that, just ask me when I had 2 or 3 drinks. And I tell you how smart I was. But I really don't know why I made that last trip from New York. I know now today, but I don't know why at the time, because there was no job out here to go to. There was nothing that I had heard was happening in San Francisco. Only on previous times there were different jobs starting, and I'd come out for those jobs. And there was nothing happening this time. And but then I did hear of a job up in Helen's Creek job. It was a hydroelectric job up in Lake Cushon and Shaver Lake up there, up over Dinky Creek up there in the mountains. And I was going to go for it. I was trying to get hired there. Didn't realize I was unemployable. Nobody had hired me. Looked like dead warmed over. A liability walking into the office. Afraid I'd drop dead signing my name. Couldn't sign it. Shake. And but that's where I arrived on the bank of Shaver Lake. And I was thrown up. And this was the first time for years I'd walk around the apartment or whoever's apartment I was in, and I'd be saying, I have to do something about this drinking. I have to do something about this drinking. And I'd go to the fridge, knocking in the fridge. I'd walk up and down the apartment. I have to do something about this drinking. I'd go to the fridge again, as if a miracle was after happening. All of a sudden, a six-pack or a bottle or a beer was after arriving in the fridge with my idea in my head that something's going to happen here. There's a beer going to arrive out somewhere. But I did something about my drinking. I used to go and get that first drink. Always. And it was back all over again. Until this time, up at Shaver Lake, I said, and I don't know, I never knew anything about a spiritual awakening, or I never knew anything about it. I knew there was a God that I was raised with, and I knew that I did not want anything to do with that God. It was a strong Catholic family from the Republic of Ireland, and my mother, she wore out more rosary beads than, she had a bunch of scrap metal in the corner from rosary beads, worn out, praying for me and my brother. I don't know who had the bigger pile, here and here. But I did say that day, that afternoon, I said, if there is anything up there, or anybody, I need help. Now. And I was crying, throwing up, dry heaving. You remember those dry heaves when your belly button hits the back end of your spine, not the front of your spine, the back end of it. And sometimes I thought the heart was there looking back at me. And I said, if there is something up there, I need help now. Within an hour, I had a seizure, which was my second seizure. Both my seizures were on the West Coast, so there was something keeping me coming to the West Coast. And somebody called the ambulance, the paramedics, had a heart attack to figure. And to this day, I think those ambulance guys were in the program. It was two hospitals in Fresno, the general and the community. The community had the ARC was in the community hospital at the time. And they landed me at the ARC. This was in November of 80, and I stayed under for what was it, 4 or 5 days, detoxing. And two women came in to me then when I came to, and I had my wits about, well, they figured I had the wits about me, but I was just enough to pay attention to what they were saying. I can tell you, I'm so grateful for these two ladies. They told me about their lives, what they were like, what happened. And I could see how they were then. I was sure they were shooting me a line of bow, because they were two of the finest women I ever saw. And I used to say to myself, where were they 2 months ago? How come I never met women like that out there? Maybe I did. And they didn't want to meet me, my condition. But you know what? They said, why don't you try this rehab for the 30 days? And if you don't like it, they cut you loose, and all your misery, they said, is back out there waiting for you. Where did you drink? Oh, mostly drank up on Geary Boulevard. We know it. It's still up there. And there's pluses with the misery you left behind. And I said, by God, I will try it. But I was broke. I had no money. A guy that came up the mountains with me from San Francisco, he dropped me off. And he had a problem with alcohol as well, and so did his brother back in New York. He dropped me in a rehab center on the West Coast. He flew back to New York. He put his brother in a rehab center back there, and he never got sober himself. As I talked to him about a year and a half ago, he was in a pub in New York, and he said, I put two of you, he says, and one on each coast. He says, and you both of you are sober today, and I can't get sober. And I said, you know where it's at. He says, the brother is driving me mad, he said, for years. But that will just show you, this program is for the guys and the girls that want it. There's a lot of people who need it. But anyway, I went through the 30 days rehab, and whatever rebellion I was carrying on, or whatever body language I was giving them, they wouldn't give me my graduation medallion. And my therapist told me, no, he says, you're not going to make it, you son of a bitch. He says, you're not honest with yourself. and you weren't honest with us. And I left that rehab centre with a vengeance of defiance. I said, I'm going to show that son of a bitch. These Yanks know nothing about us Irish guys. But anyway, I was got back to San Francisco, and where do you think I went? I went to the Blarney Stone pub, because my bags were upstairs in an apartment and some of the guys were renting upstairs. And got my bags and I went downstairs. You know, I put my hand on the door to go in, and Sutton told me, you're making the wrong decision here. And I went in and I asked a guy for a dime that I knew, and I asked for this guy's phone number. And the same guy I called was sitting beside me over at Christ Lutheran there a couple of weeks ago. He became my sponsor. He was a guy I knew when I was drinking. And he says, I called him up and I told him what was after happening to me, and he says, where are you at? I said, I'm outside the Blarney Stone. There were pay phones at that time. Out on the side of the street. And they worked, you know. And he came over and he says, if you're inside, you can stay there. And I said, no, I'm outside. And I'm sitting on my bag. I said, I had an old seaman's bag that I had. I don't know how it came about. If I came across it, but I had it anyway. Somebody gave it to me or I took it. I don't know. But it's all I had. And he came and picked me up. And we went to a meeting. I think it was a 2 o'clock meeting somewhere he knew. I don't know where it was even. And then he landed me at this halfway house, Henry Olaf House in San Francisco, in the Fillmore district. And I stayed there for 3 months. Got myself a job with some of the guys I used to drink with. But you know what? They were very supportive. I had to be back there at 6 p.m. every evening or I'd be locked out. And I knew if I was locked out, I was in deep shit. And I told them that, and one of the engineers off the job, he used to make sure I was home. One night he got me home at 6:01. I just got my foot in the jamb of the door. He was just closing the door. I said, hey, I'm here, buddy. I'm not going to let go of what you guys have got. And I was willing to go to any length to stay sober. That guy, Mel, became my sponsor and still is my sponsor. We communicate a lot by phone. And so every time I'm up in San Francisco, we go to a meeting. And now that he knows where I'm at, he'd be passing up and down and he'd come over this way. But, you know, he told me, he says, I'll be your sponsor, he said. And he says, I'm not leading you around with a hand. If you want this program, if you want to stay sober, if you don't want that life that you have led, he says, I work with you. But if you think you're going to be here BSing me, wasting my time, when there's somebody out there that really wants this program, you've got another thing coming. So I didn't believe him, actually. I called him up one evening and I said, are you going to a meeting? Yes, he says, I am. I says, which one are you going? He said, I'm going to one over in the Presidio. Oh, good. He says, I'll see you there. And I was living the far side of town. The buses didn't run too good and it was raining. And I ran the whole way to the Presidio. I wanted that meeting. And I wanted to prove to that son of a bitch that I wanted to stay sober. You know, we laugh about it today. This is a comical, deadly disease I have. And some strange things happened to me. And I ended up in strange situations that I can laugh about today. You know, but at the time, when you have the shakes, they don't seem too funny. It doesn't seem too. There's no gaiety about it. But I can laugh at the survival rate I had. You know, I remember staggering out of a bar in Canada back in the 60s, early 60s, mid 60s was a funny place. We were just talking about it earlier, and when I was up in the Yukon there was no alcohol on a Sunday. So we used to drive across the border into Alaska, where I didn't know I was going to end up for 30 years, but there was this bar called Action Jackson's right across the border, and midnight sun is really and truly the midnight sun, and mosquitoes work at night. Believe me, we were just talking about that area, and I did pass out outside and I ended up in bad shape from the mosquitoes. The mosquito should be the Alaskan state bird. You know, And this is the truth. I saw two mosquitoes fight over a guy's lunch one time. Yeah, the guy walked away and left them fight over it. But yeah, they are monstrous mosquitoes. They should be the state park. But you know, getting back to the program and how I stay sober today. I stay sober today by coming to meetings like this, listening to speakers, or going to non-speaking meetings, open or closed meetings, it doesn't matter. I love an open meeting because there's always a newcomer. And by the way, welcome to that newcomer. If you want what's in these rooms, the best meeting you ever went to, I was told, is your next meeting. That's the best meeting you could possibly go to. And that's how I'm sober today, because I always looked for the next meeting. Some meetings were better than others, some meetings I didn't like. I know today the reason I didn't like meetings was because I was a closed-minded, thick-headed immigrant. I didn't want to hear what you had to say about me, because everybody in these rooms tell my story. Not at all. Some parts of it I identify with, most alcoholics in recovery. And you know the steps. You know, my insanity, my alcoholism, I'm so insane with my disease. Even today, if I'm not working my steps properly, if I'm not doing what I was advised to do, what you guys tell me you do, if I'm not doing that on a daily basis, I can be just as insane as if I'm after throwing down, knocking back a bottle of Johnny Walker Black. And I can tell you, it's no nice place to be living, is in between my ears, because it's the worst neighborhood in America. And you think the Bronx is bad? Hey, just hang out in here for 20 minutes. And I hang out in there not as often as I used to, but there's always a lunatic in there, a madman. And I compare my disease, the insanity, as I was diagnosed with cancer by a doctor who I never met before in my life. I didn't know him from Adam. I didn't know how many surgeries he had performed. And I didn't know if any of them were successful, or how many he lost, how many patients he lost. I said to him, "Doctor," says, "what's the story here?" "Well," he says, "you got cancer." I said, "Okay, what do we do about it?" He says, "We open you up, we go in, and hopefully we can get the lot and cut it out." I says, "Okay, let's go for it." Never knew this guy in my life. He was referred to me by, I don't know whether the guy was an alcoholic that referred me. But he might have been a drunk. But, so we went anyway, we did what we had to do. And seemingly he got it all. That was 11 years ago. But I, when I think back on that, so how easy I was to submit to this guy, getting at me was a bloody night. And when I said to my sponsor, when I asked him to be my sponsor, I says, "What do you have to do now? What do I have to do to stay sober?" "First thing you got to do," he says, "is go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I says, "You're full of shit." 90 meetings in 90 days with those deadbeats? I said, "You've got to be crazy." "No, if you want to stay sober, that's what you have to do. You've got to read your big book, and you've got to do what I tell you I did, or the possibilities of your drinking are enormous." And I knew this guy. I drank with him in the Bronx and in Alaska and in San Francisco. He was 3 years sober at the time. And here I was, put my life in the hands of a guy with a bloody knife that I never met before in my life. And I was reluctant to listen to a guy who had proven to me by his appearance and by 3 years without a drop of alcohol or a drug that what he was telling me that he did worked for him. And I says, "You're full of crap." That will tell you the insanity of my disease. And that's how I compare it. Both ideas were insane. Committing myself to a guy with a bloody knife that I never knew, and all I had to do was go to 90 meetings in 90 days and do a few simple things. That this guy told me at a meeting in San Francisco when I... He says, "You know what?" He says, "If you do a few simple things here on a daily basis that are suggestive, you'll never find it necessary to sober up again. Never find it necessary to sober up again." When I thought about that, of all the times that I lay You know, I lay in that bunk alone with the shakes, with the sweats, with the horrors, with the ideas of death, the imaginary choking. Did that ever happen? Afraid to swallow that you would choke. And all these crazy ideas. What it said in the big book, in Bill's story about pulling your the mattress downstairs for fear you'd go out through the window. I have done that in New York. I went away down and slept under the back stairs of a building in the South Bronx, and I was in the horrors. And it was no nice neighborhood, I can tell you that. That's Fort Apache neighborhood. And I was afraid, the madness in my head, that I was going to go out through that window. We were up on the sixth floor. That's the craziness. And when I heard that, you'll never find it necessary to sober up again. Man, I grasped onto that. And like Ron said before me, I do my first three steps. Bang, bang, bang. In just lying in bed when I wake up. I'm grateful I'm awake. I'm grateful I'm alive. And I'm grateful I know that I'm powerless over alcohol. That I know I'm powerless over alcohol. And I never want to forget that. Never. And I've no grey area. There's no grey area in my head about being powerless over alcohol. The only grey in my head is on the outside. There's no grey matter even on the inside. But I will never forget that first half of that first step. Admitted I'm powerless over alcohol. I never hear of alcohol again in the 12 steps. I'm powerless over alcohol and my life's unmanageable. My life becomes unmanageable today if I'm not working my steps. And I really want to thank you guys for coming tonight and helping me stay sober. Because if there was nobody here, I'd be definitely here with a lunatic. You know what a lunatic happens. You know what happens to a lunatic when he talks to himself? The boys pull up in the paddy wagon outside and they have the white coats on. And I'd like to thank Rick for asking me to speak tonight, and I think that's 9:30, isn't it, the sober meeting? Yeah. And you know, never forget, if you're struggling, I always find it a great remedy. Always get to another meeting. Always get to another meeting. Use the phone. I remember I used to tell that sponsor of mine in San Francisco, I didn't have a dime to call you. I didn't have a dime for the public phone. Nobody has an excuse for not using the phone today. Every time Dick and Harry has a phone, even I got a cell phone now, just can turn it on and turn it off. That's about the height of it. But no one has any excuse for not using the telephone if they feel like taking that first trip. Use the phone, get to the next meeting, read the book, get your sponsor. Talk to your sponsor, even if you have nothing to say, just ask them what time it is when you call them up. And believe me, I have done that, and it leads into working a step on the phone. You end up writing that night, and you end up not taking that first drink. And that's the bottom line for this alcoholic, is not to pick up that first drink. And the rest of the steps will help me and protect me living with myself. Because I need protection from me. Because I'm my own worst enemy. Not mum and dad. I'd love to be able to blame mum and dad, the Catholic Church, the governments and everything like that. But I'm the reason I drank. I'm an alcoholic. Eight of us raised in the one stable. Just two drunks. Go figure. So it wasn't my upbringing. It wasn't my raising. It wasn't my faith. It wasn't what happened to me through the church. It was because I'm a real alcoholic. No more excuses. If there are excuses, it's BS. I'm a real alcoholic. I need to work my steps. And I need to get that better meeting. The next one. Thank you, guys.